Welcome to the Debate at GO8 podcast series. Today we'll be talking about the Universities Accord and what needs to happen to ensure our Australian universities are fit for purpose in the decades ahead. Peter Hoy, the Vice Chancellor of the Adelaide University, is one of our most respected higher education leaders, and we'll be seeking his views on this important issue, as well as the proposed merger of his university and the University of South Australia. Are mergers the way of the future? It's an important issue for the Group of Eight, which includes the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. I'm Ron Candelars, a freelance journalist and producer, and in the studio with me is the University of Adelaide's Vice-Chancellor Peter Hoy and Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight Universities. Well, firstly, to you, Peter Hoy, we're here to talk about the University's Accord, but in order to get an understanding of your brief on this area and your understanding of universities more generally, just take us through a potted history of your academic career.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. I was born in Copenhagen, and I was fortunate to go to university and do a master's and a PhD. And during the time of my PhD, I met an Aussie girl who had traveled to Copenhagen to do a PhD as well. And we got married and had two children in the early 80s. And after 7 years in cold weather in Denmark, she said, "We're going to Australia. Are you coming?" And that's what I did. And I had a traditional academic career, became a professor at the University of Adelaide. And then in 1997, I decided to go out and try to apply research in a more tangible way by becoming the managing director of the Australian Wine Research Institute. I ran that for 7 years. And in those 7, 8 years, I was also on the Prime Minister's Science Council, which was chaired by John Howard in those days. In 2004, I went to Canberra to run the Australian Research Council as the CEO. And after 3 years there, I came back to South Australia to become the Vice Chancellor at University of South Australia, which I did from 2007 to 12. I then went to University of Queensland and ran that from 2012 to 18. I then decided to retire to look after my grandchildren and come back to Adelaide. Somehow I fell into running a university again, and I'm now fortunate to run the University of Adelaide, which I've done for almost two and a half years now.
So correct me if I'm wrong. You would have to be one of the very few vice chancellors, at least in Australia, and this is almost a homecoming coming back to Adelaide and the University of Adelaide, who has run three universities.
I think I'm the only one who's run three Australian universities. There have been a couple of people who have run three universities, but a couple of them overseas.
Yeah. Which must give you an incredible insight, really, into the nuances and differences, because despite sometimes we're labelled as being an homogenous group of universities in Australia, we are actually quite different, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We have a university system made up of distinct groupings of universities, and they do differ in the intensity that they apply to certain academic endeavours. And of course, in the GO8 universities, we are very research intensive. We conduct about 70% of Australia's funded university research. So that is an important attribute of our universities, but also an incredible, to some extent, untapped resource of our Australian society.
Well, your track record, though, then sets you up perfectly to be the person here today to speak about the Universities Accord, which looks at, you know, how we make universities fit for purpose for the decades ahead. Firstly, let's not assume that everyone understands what the Universities Accord's about and where it began. Can you give us a bit of a history of what you understand its role to be and how it all came into being, this process?
Yeah, the now Albanese government, when it was in opposition before they got elected, signaled that they wanted to have a rare and very comprehensive review of the Australian higher education system. And upon Jason Clare becoming education minister, that really kicked off. And they're looking at about seven signal areas for the universities and other higher education institutions to engage with. And that process is now well underway, chaired by Professor Mary O'Kane, AC, who actually happened to be a predecessor of mine at the University of Adelaide, but she went on to have a strong career as the chief scientist of New South Wales.
Well, you mentioned seven areas. But in terms of the priority list, what would you see as the biggest, most important areas? Is it research funding, upskilling the Australian workforce, international student numbers? What are the big issues?
The most important thing is to try to figure out how does the higher education system position Australia best for the future? And I happen to believe that if you have a strong education system to which people don't have too great barriers to gain access, and that education system is one that is not only about knowledge transfer, but also knowledge generation and application, then you have the basis for a strong society. It was Nelson Mandela who said, education is the most powerful means by which you can change society for good. And I do believe that we are very fortunate to live in a strong democracy. There are very few fully functional democracies left in the world, and you have to work on it to preserve it. And to my mind, if people don't feel left behind, and that is if they get an opportunity to be the best they can, they buy into democracy. But you also need prosperity, and that prosperity will only come if we are an ambitious country that strives to seek out new knowledge, fundamental knowledge that surprises us about what we can do, but also new knowledge that is defined by a problem we think is too hard to solve, but which invariably we will solve because we have a disproportionately strong research sector in Australia. What we are not particularly good at is to connect it with a commensurate business investment in R&D. And that, to me, is a huge issue for Australia.
Do you think we're ambitious enough? And do you think we've got the courage to be bold? Because Mary O'Kane, as Peter said, former Vice Chancellor at University of Adelaide, but Mary O'Kane and Minister Clare are imploring us to be bold and imagine a future of, you know, in 2053, what will it look like? So this is not about tinkering at the edges and just putting out the begging bowl, as, you know, often happens. It does require us to almost go blank slate, what do we need it to be? And I just wonder if we look at our track record, and you've been around a long time, do we have that courage to be bold and to make those suggestions to government? And then would government, whomever's in government, have the courage to actually make some of the fundamental changes that we think ought to be made?
Well, we'll see what comes out of this accord. Certainly on the government side, it's a good place to start. I do hope that people take the opportunity with the accord to not look at today's problems that we need to solve tomorrow. We have to do that as BAU. What we have to do is to look 30 years into the future and ask ourselves, how are we going to resource and organize ourselves to be a prosperous country, not only because we're endowed with natural resources, but because we are fully applying our incredible capacity to compete with the best in new products and services, not only to be self-sufficient, something that we learned that perhaps we had left a little bit behind during COVID, mm-hmm. but also for us to be providers of the best that the world can get. So that will require policy changes, and it will require a different attitude to innovation and R&D investment in the broader business sector. R&D is still by many seen as a cost, but actually the return on investments in R&D are very high. As many investors will find that if you have a balanced portfolio in innovation-driven businesses, over the long term, your returns will likely be bigger.
But our history in this space is not particularly good. I heard some numbers about OECD nations, and Australia is one of the lowest when it comes to, you know, manufacturing goods from its own research, et cetera. Mm. And that's been, you know, ever thus, it seems. So with the accord process, how do you crack that nut, in the long term?
Well, I think we have to, in the accord process, ask why is it that Australia, which in 2008 was sitting bang on the percentage of GDP we invested in research, 2.25%, and the OECD was at 2.24%. And when we look at it today, where the OECD has grown to about 2.63%, we're sitting in 1.79%. You say, who is it that has dropped out of the race? Well, universities since that time, on the back of very, very strong service export earnings, have actually grown its share of the pie. But business has really dropped the ball in R&D. So I think if you want that connectivity, how do we incentivize business to better connect with the incredible strong research resource the country possesses? And I think it's through the incentives that, quite frankly, are set for the people who run companies, but it's perhaps also in approaches to taxation. What kind of research is it that you really can get a tax deduction for, and what is really, quite frankly, just your BAU and you shouldn't do it? So you drive people towards investing in true innovation rather than BAU.
So we looked at that issue, you know, how do we commercialize some of the research that's done at our universities? What are some of the other big issues that you think that the Accord will tackle? Like, what about the issue of international students? We've seen that it is both fundamentally important to the universities, but it could be argued that they became overly reliant on overseas students, and that's had an impact on research money as well.
Yeah, so the first thing to say is that I do believe that 9 out of 10 jobs going forward will require some post-year 12 education, and a lot of that will be university education. So we got to look at whether the pathways into those educations are optimal. And this is not only about universities or TAFEs. It's also about whether our schooling systems actually produce enough fully prepared students after year 12 to go on to a post-year 12 education. And further down the track, it has to look at what happens in the early years and how do we set kids up for success and failure. So we're part of a system and we can't forget that. So that's something we have to get right. In terms of overseas students, I think we have to one day realize that the countries from which most of our international students come, in 30 years' time, many of them will have generated their own ability to educate their own populations. So that will diminish the flow of international students unless we get new markets. But secondly, if they're very large economies, many international students would want to get educated in those emerging education, higher education providers. So the country must find a way in which it says we must have as an underpinning factor a strong knowledge and education system and a strong innovation system. And how do we organize ourselves to be able to afford that? And one of the key ways to do that is to grow the economy. And we do that through being smarter about applying the incredible fundamental capability we have to generate new products and services that the world wants to buy. I think that's the way forward. Fundamentally, I do not believe that the long-term relying on a few large nations having lots of citizens coming here to educate themselves is a sustainable strategy. I think it's too risky. And COVID, I think, showed us that it could be.
Yeah.
And I think it distorts our research funding model. I mean, we should still have a healthy international education sector, and we want that for a whole lot of reasons not to fund our research. And so Peter's right. We actually need to get the systemic and structural issues resolved in terms of how research is funded in this country. And you've raised a really good point about business investment in research, et cetera. And at the same time, really think about, well, why do we want an international education sector? And we want that not to fund research, but because it's the right thing to do. We're in the region. Mm. There's a whole lot of pluses to international education, aside from the economic, in terms of the geostrategic, political, soft diplomacy, et cetera. And so I think increasingly, particularly for Australia, given the region we're in, you know, we've got the ASEAN region just sitting above us. There's potential, huge potential for greater collaboration, both at education, but in that research level as well, building capability for both the ASEAN nations and us. There's a lot we can learn. It's often prefaced in the context of, you know, we will help you build capability. Well, no, there are some very advanced economies in those countries where we can learn a lot from them in both, you know, the education side and the research side.
And I think another thing that we have to think, we have some national research priorities, and I think a nation should have that. They're not the only things we need to do, but it's good to focus on a set number of top priorities. But we haven't really set out how do we fund that in a sustainable, ongoing fashion, and how do we make sure that a fluctuation in domestic student numbers or international student numbers does not defund that fundamental research that should be invested in national priorities. So I think the Accord should think about how they stably fund, irrespective of student demand, the things that we must be good at. And we can't let what gets researched be dictated by what students want to study, certainly not wholly. I mean, imagine if there is a it's a show on television, LA Law or Crime, whatever, and everybody wants to be forensic scientists, but we actually can't afford to invest in physics.
Yeah.
And people say, well, all the people who are going to make AUKUS happen. Well, we didn't stably invest in those critical environments. To my mind, the nation needs to think about how do you stably fund, irrespective of student demand, the core research we must be able to do?
Yeah.
And how do you make sure you don't have a single point of failure? So if there is one, let's just say it was nuclear science.
Yeah.
Is it possible to say that you need a minimum of three areas, preferably geographically spread, that actually underpin that? So if one goes pear-shaped, you still have two. The right number could be two, I don't know, but we must make sure that that happens.
And also we must make sure that, you know, as this over time, you're saying this, hopefully the shift away from a predominance of international students to domestic students, we have to make sure that those domestic students that come into the universities have the STEM subjects that are required for that sort of work. But also, I suppose, you've got to make sure that there's sufficient equity built into enrolments, et cetera, into our universities. Do you think the Accord should really be looking at that as well?
I think the Accord has to be looking at that, because we have over the past few years seen, I think, a distortion where price signals have been used, I believe, to direct students to certain areas. And you've got to be careful about what you do and understand what you do, because we now have in certain areas the students paying 93% of the cost of the education and the Commonwealth's 7%. I believe to almost make it more unattractive to be in those areas. And then they have similarly reduced the student fees in areas where they want to attract a lot of students, but there hasn't been parallel compensation for the universities. So you have this perverse situation where it makes more sense for a university to encourage enrollment in areas that a former government at least seemed to not want them to go.
Yes.
And that brings me to one thing that the Accord really has to do is don't make higher education policy on the run, almost in the dark, without consulting those who actually understand how it works. It is a complicated task to run.
So you obviously think we've had way too much of that for too long.
I do believe that in the last decade or so, that the trust between government and higher education providers deteriorated. And I do not wish to be political, but I do wish to say that the very open and transparent way in which we are seeing engagement now since 2022 is the right way to go. It doesn't mean that you can't disagree, but at least you know what you disagree about.
So we'll move on shortly to another topic, but just to finish up on the Accord concept, what is your vision of the University of the future then?
Well, I think there is not the University of the future. There is the university system of the future, which has the appropriate funding for what they have to do for Australia to get both the innovation drive they need, the fundamental research it needs, and the skills and access to higher education that it needs. At the moment, it is arguable that we do not have sufficient differentiation in those missions, and people are trying to do things where they cannot necessarily make the greatest contribution to society, or being asked to do something that actually is not sensible. For example, and I don't think Brian Smith would mind me saying this, we all absolutely believe that low SES students have to have access to higher education, and we need more of those students gaining a higher qualification. But at the end, the ANU is in an area of the country where there are no low SES codes. So you've got to be cognizant of the environment and people operate in and what they're uniquely positioned to do best for the country.
Yeah.
So that's the system. That's the systems differentiation that I think we need to revisit.
Now, it's great to have you in here today because as a previous Vice Chancellor of the University of South Australia and the current Vice Chancellor of the University of Adelaide, you are perfectly placed to give us a bit of an insight into the issue of the merger. How's it all going?
Well, I think it's going well. I mean, we signed a statement of cooperation with the Premier of South Australia and the Federal Education Minister, Jason Clare, in December 2022. And we are now going through a due diligence phase to put a number of artifacts to each of our respective councils. And by late June, they should be in a position to say, based on what they have seen, they either agree to merge or not to merge. I'm reasonably pleased about the way we went about it because we actually settled very early on what is the name of the new university going to be,
mm-hmm.
what is the process for selecting a new vice chancellor for the new university should it come into existence, and it was an open global search. And similarly with the governance of it, how are we going to populate the governance body. They're the things that mergers often fall on, and it was very clear to me that we shouldn't put all our staff through uncertainty if we then suddenly say, but, oh, hang on, I thought you wanted me to run this new university. Mm-hmm. That's all. So that's going very well. I think it's a good example of how to do it. It hasn't been done at this scale in Australia before.
This will be big, though, won't it? And I mean, this will be one of the biggest units. Is bigger always better?
That depends on the funding model. People often ask me that when I engage with people, and they mention Yale, Princeton, Harvard. And I said, it is correct that if you could find 50,000 people who would give us a million each, we wouldn't have to merge. Mm. But we are in an education system where scale does matter. If scale didn't matter, we probably wouldn't have had as many international students as we have now. So in this system, scale does matter. I'll try to exemplify it. The revenue in 2020 of the three South Australian universities was exactly the same as the revenue of UQ that I ran before. And it's only the fifth largest university in Australia. But they had to pay three vice chancellors.
Yeah.
They had to pay three chief operating officers. They had to pay three general counsel, which everything else being equal means that you are spending more on running yourself than what you can put towards the academic purpose. So in this funding environment, scale does matter.
Can I just also point to the fact that this would have to, if it succeeds, probably be the first big merger since the Dawkins reforms. And Western Australia actually are now starting the process. They're a long way behind in terms of the where we are in South Australia. But Western Australia, which I think has five universities in that state, really was led by their chief scientist a couple of years ago, sort of agitating for this particular discussion. And now the Premier, Mark McGowan, has announced a very similar process and a review, at least, of mergers in that state. Not identified which universities, but I think the discussion is a live one. So I think this is part of, you know, good due diligence from in this case, South Australia. And of course, it's been on the agenda. Mm-hmm. I've been in the sector for 22 years. You've probably been in a bit longer than me, Peter. But, you know, there was talk years ago between University of South Australia and Flinders. And then we did have the UniSA Adelaide, sort of, which didn't come to fruition. And I think if you were a betting person, if it's ever going to happen, I think with somebody like Peter at the helm of Adelaide and David Lloyd at UniSA, and the Premier very supportive, you've got all the ingredients there. My question to you, Peter, though, is apart from the issues of scale that you've talked about and benefits maybe to South Australia, what do you see a reimagined Adelaide University, because I think that would be the new title, be like in the context of the accord we've just been talking about? What would its national footprint and what would its national footprint be? What would its focus be?
So one of the unique features of that university is that we bring a combined research income of about $400 million per annum, which is similar to ANU. So it will be a full spectrum research university. But also because, partly because of the state we live in, but also partly because of the DNA of University of South Australia, we will also be the second highest provider of education to low SES students. So what this university will show is that absolute excellence in research and absolute excellence in giving access to higher education are not mutually exclusive. So that's a hallmark of this. But the other thing that this university will do is that a merger gives the opportunity for us to totally redo our curriculum. It's a journey that we would have to be on ourselves, but not the same impetus because it's BAU.
This gives you a real time to reset.
Everything will be digitally underpinned.
Yeah.
Because I talked about my grandchildren before. I mean, They don't carry a lot of books to and from school. They carry a laptop. And they will be looking at us when they come to university in 5 to 10 years and say, gee, we don't even learn handwriting anymore. Why are you asking me to do an exam this way? So it will be a university that will also be modern. And we're very, very clear that all students need to have an entrepreneurial exposure. Because this is about growing South Australia's economy through future-making, partnered research, and higher educational attainment levels. That's roughly where it's going to be at.
But the University of Adelaide's currently ranked at number 88 out of the 10,000 universities around the globe.
Yeah.
And you've already conceded that a merger might see that number dip in the short term.
Yeah.
Why is that a risk worth taking?
Because if you think 5 years ahead, you wouldn't even contemplate a merger. If you think 30 years ahead, which I think we should do as leaders, in order to be stably in the world's top 100 universities, under the current funding environment, we can only do that if we get bigger. And the choice that we fundamentally have to make in this state is whether we want to have a really, really good regional university or whether we want to have absolute stably a top 100 university, which is known to do future-making partnered research. Because having that is a proxy for international and national businesses to want to set up because they know they can get access to talent. If you don't have that proxy measure, it's really hard to attract people. And some people who know the state knows that that will happen. I mean, we just set up a joint academy with Deloitte. Deloitte wants to have a service center with about 900 people here, and we are now jointly training people for that. And COVID has actually played into South Australia's other advantages. It's relatively cheap to get your first home here. You can now work wherever you want. So one of our alumni, David Hill, is CEO of Deloitte Asia. He operates out of Adelaide now, and he has 65,000 people reporting to him. I know that the chief technology officer at BHP, Lord Tyler, operates out of Adelaide. So we're played into the bigger game now if we can supply the innovation, the presence, and the personnel that companies require. And the other thing that I think we will be able to trade on one day is we will, by 2030, have more electricity generated through renewables than we need in the state. And I think in future, there will be technical barriers to trade if you operate out of environments that don't have a good ESG record. Mm-hmm. And South Australia should be able to attract companies who want to trade out of a green jurisdiction. So we need them to have some people to hire and collaborate with. That's the broad vision.
It's quite the legacy, isn't it? It should it come to fruition for you. It really is the cherry on top in terms of your career.
It's interesting. I thought when I was very fortunate to run UQ and take it from number 90 in the world to top 50, that would be my signature achievement. And by the way, this is not about me. I just happen to be a lucky bystander. But it would be nice to see it deliver for South Australia.
Well, I think actually you're being a little humble. He's more than a lucky bystander. Because you did retire. You said at the very beginning of this podcast, you did retire.
Yeah.
And he was lured back. You were lured back to run the university. And I think that's an important point to note. Peter has always been, I have known Peter for quite some time now. We've worked together over different roles. And very much, it's never about Peter. It's actually about what can he give back. And he is one of those great South Australians, we're three South Australians sitting around the table here, who did leave the state, well, actually came from another country, but left the state, worked and headed up major organisations like the Australian Research Council, but then chose to come back and give something back. And I think it's a significant legacy should it all come to fruition. And as I said, I think if it's ever going to, this is the moment in time because it just seems everything is aligning.
Mm.
And we can't ignore, I think, the opportunity that the Accord gives us to play into that narrative as well.
Yeah.
But I suppose the big thing from your perspective now is bringing the staff on this journey as well. And you've been having talks with staff over time. They obviously need to be convinced that this is an honest, thorough sort of process.
Yeah.
How's that all gone?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think I'm working with David Lloyd, and he's Irish. And I think there's an Irish saying, he hasn't told me, but it's something, if you want to go there, you wouldn't start from here. And I would be honest to say that doing this journey right after COVID is not necessarily where you wanted to start, because whilst people, I think, in general, can see the full merits of this, some of them are really tired, and this is a big process. Mm. So what we have to convince staff of is that this here is not only for us, it's for our children who we would like to call South Australia home. They shouldn't stay here always. Some of them should definitely go out and see what the very best looks like. But if we can sell that, I think we can get through this, but people are tired in Australia, I think, after COVID. And change is something that very good people get excited about, but
it's hard. It can be uncomfortable.
And one of the key things that we have said must happen for this merger to go ahead is that we get the additional resource required to actually, in the transition phase, which will be a 3 to 5 year phase, in the transition phase, that we don't ask people to both do BAU and the transformation work. And I think what will get staff over the line is the sheer excitement about what we're putting to them, but also the assurance that there will be resource to do it, so we don't have to overwork them.
Peter Hoy, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's great to be with the two of you.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder that you can always tune into the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.